Energy System and the House Energy Committee to order Wednesday. It looks like 3:34 at this point on the 29th of January. With the Senate, we have Senator Giesel, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Schauer, Senator Machicki, and myself, Chair Coghill, today, and welcome the Chairman of the House Committee, and please introduce your members.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator. With us today from the House Special Committee on Energy is Representative Lincoln, Representative Fields, and I know Representative Rusher was excused, and Representative Sponholz is listening in but has a Labor and Commerce Committee to chair, so she's unable to make it as well. So thank you, and that's who we have here from the House.
All right. I don't see any senators or reps in the audience at this point. Today, we have Kerry Kuppenreiter with us today. Thank you, and Taylor Kelly again. So thank you for being here with us. Senate Bill 123 and 151, House Bill 151, are the items on today's agenda. Appreciate the members' attention. The last joint meeting, we had the utilities before us talking about their perspective on what we're doing, and the at this point, Senate Bill 123. I appreciated the depth in the conversation. This is a stakeholder group that is a little different than the utilities. They will get a chance to address the same way the concerns. And my hope is that from listening to the stakeholders, looking at our statutory language, looking at the MOU, and then getting some extra feedback from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska at the end of it, I think is going to be important for us. So that will be the last meeting, I think, that we will do in trying to get that information back to us. Today, we'll have Chris Rose, who is the Executive Director of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP. As you can see, he has a PowerPoint in front of us. We'll have Curtis Thayer, who is the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority, with us. Duff Mitchell, who will be the Executive Director of the Independent Power Producer Association. And then a very De Severo, did I say that right? Close. Can correct me anytime. I have actually assigned new names down through the years, so, but of the Public Interest Research Group. And we'll have a meeting again on Friday. That is joint. Did we make that a joint? Is that, at 3:30 in the Budget Rich Room to take the last look at this bill before we start considering what to do with it. And then we'll take some testimony from the RCA. At this point, then, let's get Mr. Rose up and put yourself on the record, Chris, and give us your PowerPoint. And you might just give us a kind of a time frame issue, and I'll try to do that with each presenter. I didn't get a chance to do that before the meeting, so just to make sure we don't run out of time so that everybody gets a chance to have a say.
Thank you, Chairman Coghill and Chairman Hopkins and members of the committee. Thank you very much for hearing this legislation. It's really important. I also want to thank the Regulatory Commission of Alaska that has been working on this for a long time, as well as the utilities and all the other stakeholders. We're here to voice our support for Senate Bill 123 and House Bill 151. Just a quick overview of REAP. We're a nonprofit. We've been around since 2004. We have over 75 dues-paying members. Of those folks, elect 21 members to our board of directors every year. And we have a wide swath of interests on our board, including businesses, utilities, NGOs, educational institutions, and some at-large members. Our mission is simply to increase the renewable energy development in the state and promote energy efficiency. We do a lot of education and programming. I won't go through all this, but we really focus on education. We hit 700 K-12 school classrooms last year. We do all kinds of public presentations and workshops and put on conferences. We work around the state, and our focus is to increase energy literacy around the state of Alaska. This is just to be, this is the first 20 or 30 years of rail belt energy reforms through 2014. Not going to go through all this, but I think this underscores the reason that we're here. There's been many attempts over the years to reorganize the way that the rail belt grid has been formed. And first, I'd like to say that the utilities have done a great job over the last 70 years, and they all sprung up literally out of the wilderness before sometimes roads were built or transmission systems were built or the internet was here. But over time, they've all grown closer together, and that's why we're here. There's a lot of issues with how we operate as a whole.
Chris, just pause for a moment to recognize Representative Sponholz joining us. Thank you, Representative. Please continue. And Chris, just an idea of a time frame.
I'm going to try to do this in 15 minutes.
All right. Thank you.
This is an overview of some of the involvement we've had since 2011, starting with our involvement in the integrated resource planning process that AEA oversaw back in 2011. But after the legislature appropriated money to the RCA and the RCA began studying this and opened up docket 15001, we've been more heavily involved. In 2015, we urged the legislature to introduce a bill to create an independent system operator. That was House Bill 187. We did that again, House Bill 382 in 2018. Both times, it's worth remarking that we were looking at an independent board of directors or as close to it as we could. And I think we settled on some kind of a board structure where the utilities would have three or four representatives in those bills. Over the last year and a half, we have really been working with the utilities to help them negotiate the wording in the 6 or 7 page memorandum of understanding that they have now all signed, which is great news. But the reason we got involved in that is because when we first saw the MOU, we saw a lot of the functions of this entity were not mandatory. They were things like, well, if we need to do this or if we need to do that, and we said, well, we need to tighten this up. We need to have these functions be mandatory. So that has been a primary driver for us, and we've held a lot of meetings with a lot of our stakeholders over the last year and a half to try to get to where we are now. As I mentioned before, we support the legislation as proposed in the four pillars to give the RCA the authority to oversee this new entity if it is formed voluntarily, to give the RCA the authority to establish it if it's not, to allow the RC to execute regional planning, and to give the RCA the authority to pre-approve all new large generation and transmission projects. We feel like these are all really important pillars. This is essentially the problem we're dealing with. We don't have regional economic dispatch. This is one of the big things the RCA pointed out in their letters in 2015 and 2020, meaning that each of the six utilities are balancing supply and demand within their own relatively suboptimal balancing area. This is a problem for renewable energy because it limits the space those variable electrons from wind and solar can go. We have no regional planning. This would be addressed by the bill. We have no pre-approval authority by the RCA. That would be addressed by the bill. No regional reliability standards, that would be addressed by the bill. No regional non-discriminatory interconnection standards, that would be addressed by the bill. And no regional transmission tariff, which is a problem. You've probably heard of this idea of pancaking transmission tariffs, where if you're sending power, whether it's renewable or not, across the system, you're paying everybody who owns transmission along the way a tariff or a fee, which makes sometimes the cost of moving power just not economic. There is a provision in the bill that would hope to address this regional transmission tariff. That's the reference to the open access transmission tariff in the bill. So we kind of see this whole reform movement as risk management because things are changing around the world quite quickly. These are five of them that we're already dealing with. Fuel price volatility, climate risk, technology innovation, customer needs and desires are changing quite quickly, and the whole issue of grid resiliency and security. First, in Cook Inlet, as we all know, we have one producer there that's controlling about 85% of the production. So we essentially have a monopoly control of natural gas in Cook Inlet. We have relatively flat demand for that gas and a small market. We have aging infrastructure and high production costs for that gas. And we've had a lot of state subsidies that have been supporting that gas production. So that is a risk for the region. Climate risk, I'll just put up one slide here. This is an excerpt from a letter from six of the largest oil companies in the world to the United Nations that's already 5 years old, saying we need some kind of a price on carbon. And the oil companies and everybody else needs a predictable guide path. And so I think that we are seeing a lot of movement on this. And carbon price is inevitable. That's something that we have to be ready to deal with. technology innovation. This is a long list, but the first one is that wind and solar prices are falling dramatically. And the wind and solar in many markets around the country and around the world are already beating the price of generation from coal and from natural gas. So this is a disruptor. It's disrupting the market in other places. Electric transportation is another disruptor that's coming pretty quickly at us. People are using electricity for heating. We have battery storage and other energy storage devices dropping in price very quickly. So there's a lot of things that are coming at us that are going to change things, and we have to have a regional forum to address them. Over the last decade, and this is when I read this the other day, it was just phenomenal to me even. Over the last decade, wind energy prices have fallen by 70%, and solar energy prices have fallen by 89% on average. Those prices are predicted to continue to decrease. As I mentioned before, they're already the cheapest sources of power in many, many markets all over the state and around, or all over the states and around the world. This is a brand new slide, just a week old from the federal government, estimating that in 2020, 76% of all new power plants in the United States will be wind and solar. 76% of all new power plants in this year in the country will be wind and solar. Wind and solar are increasing by about 15% a year, and natural gas generators are increasing by less than 2% a year. So this is happening right now around the country, and we want more of it to happen here. This is Lazard's levelized cost of energy comparison they do every year. This one just came out about a month ago. This is unsubsidized analysis, so it's comparing apples to apples, and it shows a range for each of these different resources. And you can see that the range for solar is, you know, 3.2 cents to 4.2 cents a kilowatt hour. The range for wind is 2.8 cents to 5.4 cents per kilowatt hour. These are the cheapest resources that are out there right now. This just shows the trajectory. This is solar since 2009. You can see as the red line, which is the cost of solar goes down, that the amount of generation goes up considerably. So now we're looking at more than 60 gigawatts of solar, for instance, being installed in the country this year. Same kind of graph for wind. We're now seeing the price of wind drop so much that we're looking at another 90 gigawatts of installation of wind here in the United States this year. This is an interesting graphic that just shows the states that have passed some kind of legislation to mandate renewable energy generation or to have it as a goal. You can see Alaska is not colored because our goal is not in statute. It's not codified. These states in the dark blue all have 100% renewable electricity targets now. Most of those are by 2045. So the rest of the world, the rest of the country, is pushing pretty fast toward renewable electricity. Customer needs and desires are changing quickly. We see that with people putting solar on the roofs, but I think more importantly, businesses are doing this. 63% of the Fortune 100 now have their own climate or clean energy goals, which means they will not invest or come to your community unless you can sell them 100% renewable electricity. So this is a big issue for who we're going to get to come into the state to invest. My hometown of Des Moines, Iowa, just attracted the next U.S. data center that Apple's building, and that's going to have a tremendous economic impact for the city of Des Moines and the state of Iowa, and that's because Iowa now has almost 40% of its electricity coming from wind, 40% just from wind. And they're able to sell 100% of the power to Apple as being wind power. That's why they attracted Apple to Des Moines. Grid resiliency and security. Yes.
Thank you. On the Iowa and Des Moines slide, are those wind farms in Iowa that they're using, or are they in a different state and using the interconnection but around the lower 48?
Through the chair, I am not positive where that wind is coming from, but Iowa, on a percentage basis, has more electricity come from wind than any other state. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have as much wind, absolutely, as Texas,
right.
But it has more wind per capita than any other state. So I'm assuming it's coming from Iowa, and they have plenty of wind there. In fact, I think there's more wind capacity in Iowa than the Iowans can use, and so they're delivering that power to places like Kansas City and Chicago and Minneapolis and so on.
And that's through the interconnection that they have among their utilities and their transmission system down there.
Absolutely. The transmission system essentially acts as the storage system.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they're able to have 40% wind there without any battery energy storage. They are sopping up those variable electrons as quickly as they generate them, and they always have a place for them to go. Because, as you pointed out, the balancing area or the grid area is much larger there. So these electrons can go a lot of different places, and that's kind of the issue we've got here in the rail belt is we don't have a regional grid where those variable electrons could go regardless of where they're produced. So grid resiliency and security, this is a big issue for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, cybersecurity in particular.
Before we move on, Representative Svanholz also wanted a question.
Thank you. I just have a clarification. If you back up a couple of slides to your map of the country, you said that the state of Alaska doesn't have a policy regarding renewable energy, and I think that the governor just mentioned on Monday that we passed a policy in 2010 which required 50% of our energy in Alaska come from renewables, and I'm wondering, you know, there seems to be a discrepancy between those two things, and I'm wondering if it's the way that renewables is defined that means it doesn't meet the criteria for this map. Could you address that?
Through the chair, Representative Svanholz. House Bill 306, which was passed in 2010, had the 50% by 2025 goal. Mm-hmm. That's not codified. So it's not a mandate. It's not even a goal. I've asked the people who make these kinds of maps why we're not even on there for a goal, and they said it's not codified. And I actually mentioned this to the governor yesterday. It's not codified, so it's not a mandate.
It's in an uncodified section of law, so it's sort of an aspirational thing. But
it's an aspirational goal. Right. And meanwhile, some of those other states have at least codified goals.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So grid resiliency and security is a big issue for the RCA. I'll just show this one slide, which I think tries to underscore the point we're talking about with economic dispatch and renewables. This is a quote from Director of Market Operations at Xcel Energy, which is a huge utility in Colorado. And it says, when utilities pool their generation assets and dispatch them together, you get greater efficiency and flexibility. Those two things combine to help renewable integration. That's really the point of why REAP is interested in economic dispatch, because it's going to broaden the pool, the area that these renewable energy resources can go into. Interestingly, too, Xcel Energy, even though they fought originally the renewable portfolio standard in Colorado, they fought it vigorously, and the people in Colorado actually voted on their own without the state legislature to create the renewable portfolio standard in Colorado. Xcel at first fought it. Now Xcel has just become the biggest large utility in the country to say they're going 100% renewable electricity. So they've gone full circle from saying we don't want a mandate to saying we're going to be the first big utility in the country to go 100%. I do have a few concerns on behalf of REAP that I'd like to mention here, and the first is just the governance concerns. The governance board is outlined in the MOU, not the legislation, but in the MOU that the utilities negotiated is not an independent board. And when we were working with the utilities to tighten up the language, as I mentioned, the functions being mandatory and so on, we didn't have any leverage to really change that. The other thing that is worth noting is that if AEA weren't a state entity, it would essentially be classified as a utility. It owns generation. It owns transmission. So one way to look at this is that there's actually seven utilities on this board and five non-utilities. That's one way to look at it. We would like to see somewhere a requirement that minority positions of the RRC in the IRP process, integrated resource planning process, are reported to the Regulatory Commission. So as we move forward, if there are positions that are non-consensus and minority positions are reported to the RCA, at least the RCA can consider that when they're deciding whether or not to modify or approve an integrated resource plan. And we would also like to see, and this is, I guess, from a commitment from the utilities at some point, that this will, the governance board will evolve over time. And that's exactly what's happened in other states. Some of these entities have been established, and then over time, they are, the governance boards are increasingly independent. Right now, we have essentially six market participants on this board, and they're all being required by this proposed legislation to put on their Railway Reliability Council hat when they're in the boardroom, but it still is a concern for us. Other thoughts? We hope that the local planning and the reliability criteria that exist in the statute don't create some unintended loopholes that would somehow defeat the purpose of integrated resource planning or the ability of the RCA to pre-approve projects. We want to make sure that those processes are strong. We'd also want to make sure that the legislation contains enough elements to make sure that we do move toward a universal transmission tariff in the rail belt, so we don't have pancaking transmission tariffs. Like to see a commitment toward merit-order dispatch. As you know, the RRC MOU just says that when it's established, the RRC will study merit-order economic dispatch.
Chris, if you don't mind, probably just so that I can keep things reasonably even-handed, the MOU is very different than the statutory rule. And as we go forward, it's going to be important that we don't cross them over, because one is an implementation issue that can be dealt with both at the Reliability Council and its makeup, and the RCA as it entertains that. So help me keep those two things divided. And we've crisscrossed over them a couple times. And for those who are listening in, those are two very different things.
Absolutely. I just wanted to make sure that the committee understood some of the issues that were involved with the MOU process. We want to make sure that the interconnection processes are non-discriminatory for both getting into utility networks but also the wider transmission system. And this last point is just, we believe the legislation should reflect the needs of Alaskans and not necessarily the needs of the utilities MOU. You heard the utilities testify on Monday that they would like to see the legislation comport to the MOU, and we don't think that's the way it should go. We believe that the legislation should protect Alaskans first. So this is, in summary here, what we think reform could do. It create more of a level playing field for renewable producers and stabilize energy prices and lower our carbon emissions, attract investment, diversify our economy, and prepare us for, I think, a future that's going to change quite quickly over time. I guess the only last point that I would try to make is that we really are moving forward in good faith with the utilities. We've had a lot of good meetings with them over the last year and a half or so. But this last effort to change the legislation, Senate Bill 123, and bring a committee substitute was not something that we felt was a good process. At first we thought, well, it'd be okay to try to wordsmith a little bit, but when it turned into a total rewrite, we were really concerned about that process. And we hope that as we move forward and, implementation committee is formed and the RRC is formed, that, the processes will be a little bit different and not so rapid. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Any questions? I'll have one comment, mainly because it's something I push back on with the utilities as well. But it's something I'll push back on you. Probably as we contemplate this statutory new authority, which would create a reliability council, for the first time you're going to have utilities who have a diversity of needs. It can be very different for integrated resource planning than you would say have in another place where you dealt with a single utility. So I think people need to understand that this is a unique challenge in that regard, that you have different geographical economies that are going to be dealing with integrated resource planning very differently than a single utility. And I think that needs to be made clear so that when we have them on a council like the Integrated Resource Council, that they do bring a disparate point of view, and I think that needs to be highlighted. It's something that it's been more obvious to me, maybe. And I just wanted to test you on that to see if you feel like if there are utilities on there, that their different needs are so diverse that there would be that natural tension, as well as having other members on that board. Do you see that as a reasonable pushback?
Chairman Coghill, I do. I think that this is a let-go moment for the utilities, and they all want to be on this implementation committee and on the governing board, and that makes total sense to me because, as you pointed out, there's different resources in different parts of the rail belt. There's different needs. But having said that, I don't think they're that different, and I think that you know, when combined with the other stakeholder points of view and representation, that we will have a really good group of people who are bringing up issues that maybe the utilities may not bring up on their own if it was just them in a room.
And then one last challenge, and then I'll shut up. You said the utilities are interested in what the utilities do, and you're interested in the public good, but they have to have a certificate of public convenience, and the RCA does hold them to the public good. And I didn't want that to go unnoticed, that they do have to serve customers under that directive. And so it is true they're interested in their operations, but their mandate is to deliver reliable at the lowest cost service.
Chairman Coghill, I totally agree, and they do a great job of it. I guess when the ERO gets certificated, though, we want to make sure that there's broad consensus that this is for the public and that we're all working for the public good on that ERO.
I'm not trying to make their case for them, but I'm just trying to bring that out so that those of us who have to contemplate this get that kind of push-pull picture. All right. Thank you. Any questions at this point? Chris, thank you very much. Well said. So, okay, next we'll bring up Curtis Thayer, who's the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. And welcome, Curtis.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. The Alaska Energy Authority has one simple goal, and that is to lower the cost of energy in Alaska. We do that through owned assets, Bradley Lake, the Alaska Intertie primarily. We are also working on Battle Creek as a diversion project into it. We also have rural programs where we look at 195 communities and where we, with PCE, but of those 195 communities, we tend to be responsible for the powerhouses and bulk fuel, upgrades to those communities. And in addition to that, we do different grants, the Renewable Energy Fund. We also have a power project fund. But for my purpose here today is to discuss AEA's perspective as regard as an asset owner of Bradley Lake and the Alaska Intertie. And we do that as the Alaska Energy Office. As far as SB 123 is concerned, relationships and the impacts on the AEA-owned assets. Bradley is currently managed by the utilities and our participants, and we have the Battle Project Management Committee, which AEA participates. They do the operational maintenance decisions, and we'll be informed, and we are informed by outside agencies, as currently the case. So we have that feedback. Budget for required improvements is not impacted by SB 123. The state does not give away its any fiduciary rights or responsibilities, but still has clear step-in rights on budgeting matters on AEA assets. Alaska's intertie has the maximum the intertie transfer capacity rights, MITCR, and the Alaska intertie managed by the utilities through an intertie management committee similar to the BPMC for operational maintenance
Curtis,
decisions.
Could I interrupt you for a moment? I need to shut this other slide down. Otherwise, you're always going to be talking with that looking over your shoulder. I know you were on a roll, so.
That's all right. I chose not to do the 35-page slide presentation.
Yes. Before we go forward, I think Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Senator Director. We had an issue yesterday with a lot of acronyms. What is the BPMC?
Sorry, that is the Bradley Project Management Committee.
Gotcha. Thank you.
So it's the participants in Bradley Lake, which are all six of the utilities and AEA.
Thank you.
The SB 123 impact for energy policy from AEA's perspective is it's more intentional and less prescriptive, which is in statute, which is always better for all parties, especially as years go on and we look back at the legislative intent. This really ensures that allows RCA to play a proper regulatory role. This allows for maximum flexibility for the Electric Reliability Organization to create rules of the road and to meet Alaska-specific situations. Planning functions should be closely aligned with a statewide effort, and flexibility and bifurcation should be maintained. And then really, in conclusion, SB 123 is the right vehicle at the right time. Institutional reform has long been sought. Combination of new technologies and railroad utility synergies currently do exist. We have in the last year worked very closely with the utilities. I think if you were to look at Swan Lake Fire, the SQ line, those issues really brings it home. We learned a lot. I say we collectively. I think the utilities, AEA, learned a lot. But that fire cost the utilities in the ratepayer north of Homer about $12 million when that line was down for 4 months. And this is an example of what we can look at to look to how we can improve transmission lines and look at see what we can do with not just that one section of line, but across the state. SB 23 gives a very deliberate consideration of the right mix of technical know-how. You need the utilities in there for utility expertise and also the regulatory oversight. It will ensure the greatest success. And if it's successful, that's going to benefit the ratepayer. And through that, we lower the cost of energy. So,
Curtis, did you have a written portion that could be submitted to the committee?
Yes, I will clean this up, but yes.
All right, thank you. Because you were spitting it out pretty fast. So, Senator Giesel and then Senator Machicki.
Thank you. Mr. Thayer, could you explain why Bradley Lake is not regulated by the RCA?
It was an agreement that was reached during the construction that is the bonds will be defeased next year, so that's a conversation to be had. When I say defeased, they'll be paid off next year. And so at that time, I think that conversation will be had. Bradley Lake, we're still doing improvements. We have Battle Creek AEA is doing with utilities. It's a $47 million project that was bonded to put more capacity into the lake at 10%. So it's one thing for Bradley to say, next year the bonds are paid off. That is true. Battle Creek bonds in relation to the Battle Creek Bradley Lake continue. That project literally is going to hopefully be finished next summer. So we're at the very beginning stages of paying those bonds off. It's $47 million. So Bradley will continue to have improvement.
Thank you.
Senator Machicki.
Just wanted to make sure the committee understood that HEA didn't benefit from the being islanded either. I've heard that mentioned quite a bit. It cost everyone on the system.
Yeah.
The reality of it is they were forced to use generation capacity from the system that they plan to use this spring, and that'll have to be made up with fuel gas on the system. So no one benefited. It was an unfortunate situation that affected everyone negatively. I'm just not sure that's clear to everyone.
The rate payers on the northern end of the intertie are very well aware of it.
If I can comment through the chair, Senator Machicki, I had no that was not my intention. It was the numbers of the five utilities north that were cut off from the power. That is a number that was derived with those utilities. Homer would have a completely different set of circumstances, and we do understand that. But the issue at hand was the line was down, and we didn't have access to it. You know, they had gas and hydro. We didn't have the hydro. And hydro's about 4 cents a kilowatt as opposed to gas at 8 cents a kilowatt. So it added up quickly. But my intention was not to slight Homer in any way.
I understand.
Thank you, Senator. Other questions at this point? One of the questions that was brought up by REAP was the tension that you get to play both in the utility world and in the energy management world. Help me understand how you would see yourself in a reliability group as playing those parts. So help me understand how you see that.
Well, I think a clear indication is the fact of the six utilities signed the MOU. AEA was not a party to the MOU. And part of that is our role as a state entity. And, you know, the state owns Bradley, the state owns the intertie. We represent that ownership interest. And so we do play a little bit differently in that realm. We don't have our board and our member, as co-ops have members, we're the state of Alaska as a whole. Like I said, we are part of the process, and we have worked with the utilities. But again, we chose not to be a party. They didn't ask us to be a party to be a signature, and we didn't ask to be a signature. But I think that we do keep that distance because, like I said, we're looking at this from a holistic aspect across the state.
As we look at standing up an electricity reliability organization, I think it's important that all those things are considered, Representative.
Thank you. Just recognize also the Representative Pruitt. Thanks for joining us. As a owner and operator of the intertie from Anchorage to Fairbanks, it's a big concern for us as we look forward to an integrated resource plan where more traffic might be happening on that intertie. Do you see needed upgrades to that to allow for better and stronger reliability, especially as GVEA was telling me earlier, we saw that power line go down in the dead of winter in December, being a main concern up in Fairbanks. How do you see that future going for the intertie?
Through the chair, Representative Hawkins, or Chair Hawkins. Hawkins, one of the things with the intertie is AEA has the portion from Willow to Healy, and then Golden Valley has Healy to Fairbanks. You know, there's been a study that was done about 10 years ago looking at the rail belt needs as a whole. AEA was the primary author with a lot of parties and input on that, and it identified close to $1 billion worth of upgrades or improvements that are needed. One of the things that we're looking at AEA is to revisit that. A lot of things have happened in 10 years. Technology's changed, you know, potentially ownership has changed between some utilities and Anchorage. And so we want to look to see how that's evaluated. But really we need to look from Homer to Fairbanks, because we know that Bradley Power is shipped to Fairbanks. It's a key component, but there is potential line loss up to 40% depending on the time of the year and the amount of power. And that's because of constraints on it. So we need to look at how to unconstrain that power so we do have a clear flow from Bradley, which is the largest hydro project in the state. And at 4% is the cheapest on the rail belt for energy. So,
Curtis, yes. Curtis, wouldn't that be something that would be contemplated in a resource planning as contemplated in this bill?
Yeah, through the chair, yes. We have that role, but that's a role that we need to update. So, yes.
Other questions at this point? Curtis, thank you very much for coming for us. Next, we have Duff Mitchell, who is Executive Director of the Alaska Independent Power Association Producers. And we have a PowerPoint. We do. Duff, thank you very much for coming before the committee, and please put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and esteemed members of the Energy Committees of the representative bodies. I'm Duff Mitchell. I'm here as representing as a non-compensated executive director of the Alaska Independent Power Producers Association. When I was doing this PowerPoint today, or yesterday actually, I pulled up a 2015 PowerPoint and wanted to just cut and paste from this, but I wanted to keep removing gridlock because I was testifying 5 years ago on a similar situation of removing gridlock, and here we are today. And frankly, I think we're a lot closer. Let me see how I can upright this. So APA currently has 9 members. It's ebbed and flowed. What we have is a group of folks that are big and large. APA provides advice. It's a support group, and we share lessons learned with how individual IPPs have dealt with integrating on the rail belt, but also with individual utilities, and also on how we're dealing with the RCA. It has been a very useful group. We helped put through R13002 through the RCA, which was kind of like our advent of PURPA into the state, and that hadn't been changed since, you know, early in the 80s. And so we have been instrumental in moving the needle toward lower cost and more competitive power in the state. Just to put IPPs, which is the independent power producers, in relationship to the rest of the country, 42% of the nation's power comes from IPPs. In Alaska, we're at 4%. Some of the modeling of the ERO and the rail belt organization has come from ERCOT in Texas, and I just want to point out Texas has 78% of its power coming from IPPs. So we do play a role in Alaska, and I think we should have we're going to keep growing and have more of a role. I throw this out because in the 2016, the U.S. Department of Energy did an analysis of Alaska, and it wasn't rail belt specific, it was more with rural Alaska, but they interviewed commissioners and others, and I just want to point out one of the key recommendations was to increase the role of independent power producers and other third-party servers in Alaska. And we're more nimble, we're using private investment, we can accelerate the adoption of innovative technologies like hydrokinetic. Mm-hmm. Maybe utility doesn't want to jump in solar, but if someone wants to put their money up, this is Alaska and it's competitive and you can risk your money. And IPPs have proven that they can do that. Clearly, you know, I look at Alaska and we're the breadbasket of all energy in the nation. We have something like 45% of the nation's untapped hydropower. We have two-thirds of the coastline. In other locations in America, they're putting offshore wind. We have rivers that can do hydrokinetic. We not only have renewable energy resources, we have non-renewable energy resources. And I get up every day to whom much is given, much is requested. Alaska energy policy. I was involved with trying to get and getting this through both bodies in 2010. And it's come up and it's been mentioned even by our governor, and it's a great policy. But it has been pointed out it is aspirational rather than directional. I testified in front of the RCA at one hearing, and I was asked by a commissioner, well, this really doesn't pertain to us. And I said, well, I don't think it pertains to fish and game. I think it does pertain to you. And he said, well, if the legislature wanted it and intended it to be something that we take into consideration with our cases, they would have advised us as such. And there is nothing in House Bill 306, which created the state energy policy to do so. So it's really good. It lays out a lot of great things, but it really is aspirational rather than directional. So I want to state, and I didn't state this beginning, we support House Bill 151 and Senate Bill 123. I want to put that right out there. That doesn't mean that it's perfect. I think there's some things that can be done, and I've listened to some of the questions that folks have asked and whatnot, and I think it's going to evolve to a much better bill than maybe what it is right now. But I want to state out that we do support it. I want to highlight some things where I want to highlight to either make it better or have you at least consider or understand where we're coming from. One is open access transmission tariff. Transmission is the highway to the market. It can also be a barrier. If you come up with a great solar project and wind project and you can't get on the highway to the market, it's not going to do you any good. The ODT has recognized that dilemma and has considered that in the MOU, and I see that also mentioned in the bills. Our suggestion is expand that so it's a future RCA tool, not only just for the rail belt, but for any transmission that is owned by the state of Alaska or it's regulated by the state of Alaska. And I do like the word may. It's all right. But remember that in the last thing with the energy policy, aspirational versus directional, and this is may, so it's mother may I, and it could be the answer is no. And you guys are more well-versed at what shall and may be because you deal with it every day in all of your bills. So I just point that out to you. You know, the other thing is open access transmission tariff is the golden rule. And what it basically says is you shall treat others as you would treat yourself. And that's really what the rule is. So when you connect, you will be paying the same as what the owners would be paying or entitling themselves to. So that's open access in a nutshell. Independent board of directors. Every other rail transmission organization in America has a very strong code of conduct and an independent board of directors. We understand Alaska's smaller. We understand that not everybody's going to have the expertise to serve on that board that is completely and distinctly independent from their organization. And I say organization because I think there has to be independence on the non-utility side as well as on the utility side. I want this fair. And I think that whoever's on the board should have a fiduciary responsibility to the transmission organization as opposed to their specific interest or their interest group. I throw that out there because if you look at every other transmission organization in America, that's how they do that. If you don't, then sometimes you end up with oligopolies or you end up with cartels and you end up with things that have unintended consequences when you don't have a strong independence. So the I cut out a slide from our utilities presentation, and I just wanted to say that we really appreciate the commitments. We have not always had a perfect relationship with utilities. It's been acrimonious, but I'm an Alaskan, and when someone gives me a commitment, I take it I honor it. And so I really appreciate the commitments that the utilities have made, not only to this body, but to us. And I want to take them up on that. So some of the things that they also mentioned that I think are very good that I want to point out, cybersecurity. I read the utility magazines. We could have 10, 20, who knows what percent that is grids that have been infiltrated where someone's just waiting for the bad hair day to switch us off and cause us serious problems. We have military bases. We have in Juneau the Coast Guard District. We have lots of national security issues, and I'm really glad to see that we're taking up cybersecurity. We have had organizations, schools, cities in Alaska already impacted. This is important, and it should be all hands on deck as far as working together on that. So I really like to see the cybersecurity in there. Integrated resource planning. Integrated resource planning does not have to be expensive, but it needs public participation. We like that. We like that as maybe even giving the RCA authority as when they see fit and when they think it's appropriate that they could also have IRPs with normal utilities. In the lower 48, IRPs are a normal course of business. They are used for planning. You bring out the public. You listen to all the angles, and then you make wise decisions from it. Project pre-approval. Most states have project pre-approval in code. The RCA does not have project pre-approval. Another word is site planning. I'm not going to use the word site planning, but I think project pre-approval is really important, not only in the rail belt, but statewide. That way you make wise decisions based on all of the public good, not a parochial interest. And I'm going to add in there, since the state energy policy has come up in discussions, not only here, but with the governor, I think there could be some reference to the state energy policy, which was, it's now 10 years old, and I really want to see us make some progress on it. I think it could be mentioned in this bill. So collaboration commitment for public good. We all agree that Alaska is blessed with bountiful resources. Alaskans deserve lower cost power. Alaskans deserve the diversity of resources of electrical generation for energy security. If you put all your eggs in one basket, sometimes things happen. I think Alaskans deserve open access tariff because it is an equal playing field. And Alaskans deserve to have the RCA have the statutory tools necessary for IRPs, integrated resource plans, project pre-approvals, and to help move us along in cybersecurity. So I visualize this ODT and this RRC and the APA group sees this as a foundation. It's a roadmap. It's a journey. It's not an end state. And we have a lot of work to do, but my first slide was gridlock. I think we're moving beyond gridlock. I appreciate you guys, the body's taking this up. I appreciate all of the work that the utilities have done on this. And I think collaboration and cooperation is the new order of the day, and I'm hoping it just continues. Thank you.
Thank you, Duff, and I appreciate it. Some of the things you brought up could be done with both the reliability organization and in their planning, but there are some places. So would the open tariff question be something that would be percolated up out of the reliability organization through integrated planning, or is that something you see as a statutory requirement?
In the bill right now, it says may, and I know that there's consideration for it. Obviously, that is a benchmark foundational thing for IPPs, and so we would lean for stronger is better than less. We feel it is really, if you want to get a fair shake of anything coming on there, the open access eliminates the barriers. And I think most utilities agree.
Don't you think, though, that when we put all the utilities together under a reliability organization and you have input into it, and it coming from almost every side of that machine, if you will, because that's how it was described, has input from independent power producers now, maybe at a lower level than you would like, but there are places where that this whole thing is designed so that it can accept that. Isn't that part of how you would see reliability organization structuring itself?
I mean, like I said, it's a good step, yeah. And I see that the commitment. But when you have 3 years from now, if the commitment wanes, you don't have the same statutory strength as something along that. And I'm not saying that's not going to go there, but if you look at the past, it has been a little bit of fratricide here and there, and I don't want to put that behind us.
But isn't it true, though, that was six or eight doors to knock on, plus a regulatory agency. Now you at least have one door to knock on.
Yes, as long as that one open access is for the entire grid and it's not a two-step process, but yes, I agree.
And I favor that approach, but I'm trying to give those who are listening in on us a concept of what we're trying to do here. I think trying to take all the input from all the people and still come up with a simple and discreet way to do it. So any other questions at this point? You must have answered all the questions, Steph.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming before the committee. Next, with the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, and I'm going to ask her to tell me how her name was said so that I don't butcher it one more time. Thank you, and my apologies. I should have done that before the meeting, but please put yourself on the record.
So thank you. It was perfectly said with a French accent, so, but it's Italian, and my name is Veri De Suvero, and I'm the executive director of the Alaska Public Interest Research Group. And to the chair and through the chair to the committee, thank you so much for having me to testify. I feel very grateful to be here. A little bit of background about ACPIRG. We were founded in 1974. And we have been advocating specifically in the interest of the public and consumers since then. We're 501c3, we're nonpartisan, we're statewide. And I actually found a rate case to the RCA that we filed in 1976 as a petition to intervene. I was not the director then. I became the director about a year and a half ago. And I have really gotten up to speed thanks to so many of the people who are behind me right now, and also thanks to a bunch of stakeholders as well as folks from utilities who've taken the time to educate someone who's supposed to be representing consumers on a really technical and difficult issue that also needs a lot of legislative reform right now. So I appreciate the committee taking the time to do that. Again, I'm not here as a technical expert. I'm here as a consumer representative, and it is my and ACPERG's belief that I don't need to know everything that goes on behind the light switch to know that my utility bill is one of the highest in the nation. In addition to advocating for cost-effective and reliable service, ACPERG advocates in the public's interest, as I'd mentioned, and that entails a few things, including transparency and accessible information to consumers. As a research group, accessible information means both transmitting information already presented and compiling some of our own. So I've been through the RCA's tariff filings. It was a very fun process. But it's really critical in that way to start with the basic numbers and to engage with members and ratepayers to make sure that they're involved in this process. So that's part of why it's incredible that public hearings are happening now and that this process that the utilities have engaged in have been open. As Commissioner Scott testified last Friday, consumers could save $17 million in a yearly aggregate with just an efficiency increase of 2%. To me, that means people's budgets, individual budgets, that can be spent towards other things that they desperately need. SB 123 and HB 151 could not be coming at a better time. This is a critical first step, and to me, it underscores the timeliness of ensuring these efficiency increases are possible. So along with transparency and accessibility information, it's necessary to ensure a planning process that benefits not just one utility's membership, but all consumers. Plans are important for their cost-saving purposes and also for the importance of having the plan itself. Mr. Rose had mentioned a roadmap that oil companies had requested. As a consumer interest advocate, having a plan and having predictability and stability is the one thing that we can broadly say is definitively in the public's interest, as well as access to that information. I can't represent individual consumers, and I do not intend to speak for all people. But those are the two main points that we have of interest in SB 123 and HB 151. Again, the accessibility and transparency and the actual plan itself and the need for that. So right now, as it stands, without a planning body to create that longer-term ingrained resource, integrated resource planning, consumers are footing the bill of that uncertainty. Building out long-term economic models is crucial so that individual consumers as well as larger consumers can budget correctly for their future. I know most of this is background, but this is the lens from which we approach this issue. So I appreciate you hearing me out. ACPERG, we're not here to speak negatively about how electric utilities have taken care of their ratepayers. We are really lucky in the Rail Belt region to have cooperatives that are so responsive and dedicated to their members. And although the grid could be more efficiently served if it was built from scratch today by one utility, to me the history and the formation of these utilities is really reflective of their dedication to their consumers. In fact, ensuring their members are best served has been a big reason why, as a statewide organization, ACPERG is excited for the additional regional approach to planning. This is because regional planning has not been consistently done together, as many have mentioned. The example that I tend to talk about when I talk with consumers is that in the past decade, there have been four new generation plants built on the Rail Belt, costing ratepayers an estimated $1.49 billion. And this is for a population size, as Commissioner Scott testified, that could be served by one utility and by the equivalent of one half of one power plant in the lower 48. This increased spending creates costly inefficiencies, higher rates, and a higher barrier to enter an energy market that doesn't need more energy producers. To our estimation, none of these things serves the consumer's interests. The costs of this infrastructure have been pushed to the end user or the consumer, and by building non-renewable sources in a small balancing area, renewables are prevented from attaching to the grid, preventing a diversity of energy sources which would stabilize costs in the region. As it stands, 85% of our energy portfolio is made up of non-renewable sources. So from a diversity of resources model, that does not stand well for the consumer. These inefficiencies are part of what pushed the RCA and legislature to investigate what a regional planning body, what's being considered now an electric reliability organization, or an ERO, and then eventually, ideally, an independent system operator would look like. and the RCA's work, as well as the legislature's, to ensure greater cooperation between utilities, as well as cost savings through greater efficiency and integrated resource planning, is impressive and necessary, as well as the utilities' work themselves. That's partially, again, why SB 123 and HB 151 and the RRC, while not solving everything, will introduce a regional planning approach or integrated resource planning, and we're incredibly excited to see this necessary step happen. So again, I want to give my appreciation for it actually happening. It's almost a reality, and that's pretty extraordinary from what I've heard about the history of the involvement of all utilities, of all stakeholders, and of ACPIRG. We do a lot of public outreach. I go through Rail Belt history, about the history of cooperatives, and about how we have a pretty incredible model in Alaska, utilities that are actually in it for their members. And so what we do is, again, urge ratepayers to get involved. And that looks different. We have municipal entities that are utilities. We also have cooperatives. And so this, the new constructions of different groups is also a pretty important way of which, in which ratepayers and members will be involved. Through our regional work, we consider the needs of all the consumers on the Rail Belt and not just members. Not everyone who has to budget for utility bills is a registered member. So, for example, I'm a renter, and I don't pay the bills directly to MLMP currently. I pay my roommate, and so I would not be a member, but I'm still a ratepayer. And so how we budget and how ACPIRG does our work in order to consider the needs of all consumers is a little bit different than the purview of the utilities themselves and who their constituents are. We recognize there's an important balance to strike to ensure that cooperatives maintain local control and responsiveness to their members, but without a body to also consider the needs of the entire region, members and ratepayers can lose out on cost-effective and energy-efficient decisions, especially in the longer term. So the good news is that there's a lot of need, and there's also a lot of response in our estimation right now. And so we are very supportive of the creation of an ERO, an Electric Reliability Organization. We are emphasizing, though, with the creation, there is incredible need for successful cooperation between utilities, which we've seen and has been really incredible. Input from other stakeholders and especially the public in this process and accountability within this process in the public's interests specifically. So we have some comments on SB 123. In brief, the RRC should not be drafting the regulations which govern it. This has been mentioned a couple of times in testimony previous, so I won't belabor the point, but the RCA is mandated in the public's interest. That is their mission. The RRC has been established to ensure reliability benefits to electric consumers in the Rail Belt, and so I urge this joint committee to consider those different purposes when understanding who should be actually drafting those regulations rather than seeking input from the experts who are ideally serving on the RRC. And so, and just again, reliability benefits don't encompass a public interest determination. That's the purview of the RCA. And at the RCA, anyone can be involved in the rulemaking process, not just representatives to the RRC. The second main point is that increased opportunities for public participation. Hopefully you're noticing a theme. ACPIRG suggests, and did so to the utilities last week, without opposition, to add public participation and comment wherever public comment occurs in order to allow for as open, engaged, and transparent a process as possible. And Senator Coghill, to the question that you had asked earlier about whether or not the utilities are representative of all of the stakeholder or of some of the stakeholder needs with their diverse perspectives that they come to the table. I feel that's exactly right. They have such different needs regionally. But also, so far, this process has been utility driven, at least at the RRC level. With SB 123, it was this SB 123 has been an outgrowth of what the RCA has studied and what the legislature has commissioned. And so changing it in again, another utility-driven model in which the RRC was formed, where only the utility signed and presided over the creation of this voluntary effort, to me is the distinction between what the process has been so far in terms of involving stakeholders evenly on the same plane and what it could be going forward.
Barry, don't you think that the RCA actually has kind of the backstop to the organizational structure of what would be a reliability organization, number one, and I think they are going to be kind of the consumer advocate in many ways, as well as those who have unique consumer responsibilities, right? So do you see the RCA as kind of the way I see it in this bill, they become the place that this electric reliability organization has to answer to when it comes to its organizational structure as well as integrated resource planning? So I do see that there is that tension in there. Do you see it the same way?
To the chair, I absolutely see that. Thank you for saying that so eloquently. I'm excited not to mix the RRC and this bill, but on the RRC, there are two ex officio non-voting members, and that's one member from the Regulatory Commission and one from RAPA.
That's where I want to make a distinction to those listening in on us. What we contemplated as a reliability organization, this Reliability Council may apply, but it is not a Reliability Council at this point. It's contemplated. And so even though they've worked hard on it, and it's likely that they would be it, I just want to make that distinction for those listening in on it, because this statute contemplates that they may, but they may not. So it's something that I think is a nuance we need to kind of keep in front of us. And so as you were testifying, it could be easily understood that they've already been approved and they have not, just for what it's worth.
To the chair, thank you. I did not mean to make that assumption.
Yeah, no, it's just clarity for those listening in on us, basically, and clarity for us to think about it as legislators. Representative, you had a point?
Yeah, thank you, Senator. Thank you for coming and talking with us today and your work leading up to being here today. You were talking about including the word participation in public comment. How do you see that working in practice if that language is included versus excluded?
Through the chair to Representative Hopkins, I do not want to influence how that could be seen in the future, but I know from other models and talking to other public interest advocates that it includes public participation at meetings, more than just a comment period or a comment process, but active participation during the charrette or the formation of policy and planning. And not to override the representatives who would be selected, but for example, ACPIRG, we're applying to the consumer seat, spoilers. But we are, if it is approved. But the idea to host consumer forums, to have other types of input in this process is really critical, even with the RCA ideally as the backstop for whatever ERO is stood up, having participation be robust and not just relegated to whatever the formation of that ERO is, as well as a public comment to satisfy that, I think it gets at the increased opportunities for public participation that we would like to see.
Thank you.
And I think for my part, we have built the reliability organization with various different voices into it. And I think you'll have that healthy tension where the requirement for public input would be necessary. What I've tried to describe to the people who produce the power, to the public comments, to this committee, is I'm trying to keep from getting highly prescriptive, but directive. And in the organizational structure, I think has been pretty directive that it's going to require public input. Then the other thing is, many of the things that they'll be dealing with will be required by RCA to handle just like you would any other docket, and which requires a lot of public comment. So I don't want people to think that if it's not explicitly said directively or prescriptively in the statute, that it's not going to happen, because there's a lot of public process in this. And so, and I think for you as a public advocate, I can't imagine you sitting by without having your voice crying out for public input. So I just wanted for those listening in today to think that it is not something we're skipping over, but it's built into this organizational structure. Anyway, just keeping it at a high level. Thank you. Please continue with your testimony.
Thank you to the chair. We have two more main points on our recommendations on this bill and our perspectives on it. The first one is to pass it. It's as was brought up, this past summer, the transmission line Bradley Lake was out of commission from August until recently in December. It cost South Central and Interior ratepayers roughly $11.8 million, according to reporting by Elwood Bremer. This legislation will help create a more resilient and redundant system as our region faces increasing wildfires and other severe weather events. And so it hurt everyone. And the integrated resource planning process has to start as soon as possible. The idea of waiting, of costing, you know, ratepayers $17 million a year if we can even scale back 2% in efficiency, that urgency is very much felt by our organization and by the consumers we speak with. And our other recommendation is to pass the bill as is, with however you see fit it needs to be updated, for example, with dates and the other clarifications and suggestions that you've heard. But this bill, again, is an outgrowth of what the RCA has learned and reflects their recommendations based on 2015 substantive recommendations for reform. They're clear, again, topical changes needed. But our ACPIRG's worst case scenario is to spend so long incorporating the changes that the utilities are proposing and that others have substantively proposed that the bill doesn't pass. To our estimation, as it is written, SB 123 and HB 151 substantially serves consumers and the public's interest and is a necessary and critical step forward. I'm remarkably grateful to be invited to testify and, again, want to express my appreciation for your undertaking this important step forward in a way that will provide major benefits to consumers and to the public.
First of all, thank you for coming to testify in front of the committee, and I have it in writing, so very well said. And your consistent policy push for the consumer, very grateful. Can you tell us just broadly what the your membership consists of? I'm going to ask also Reap, because I think people need to understand this is not just a small voice. And so help us understand, as you're speaking, how many kind of collaborative voices you have to gather.
Thank you to the chair. In paid memberships, as in employees, we have four employees besides myself, one in Fairbanks who keeps me informed on GVEA and other updates. We also have a membership base of, around 50 in the Rail Belt region. And we have an annual report we just came out with. We have about 20 affiliated organizations that we work in partnership with, and we have about 10,000 people who we reach in Alaska.
Yeah, and I think it's important for people to know that your reach is fairly broad, and when you speak, the general gist of what you said today is you're interested in consumer benefits and individual benefits, right? And so I appreciate that. Is there other questions before I dismiss her at this point? Thank you very much. And if I could have Chris come up, because I wanted to ask the same question. I think it's important, if I can get Chris Rose to come up for a minute, just to explain kind of, I know that a utility has not only a board, but they have consumers, and like I am part of the co-op, we all get to have our input into it. And And since you said REAP and you kind of went over quickly that it's a broad group, but just give us a general idea of the focus and how broad this is, your REAP group.
Chairman Caldwell, we have about 77 paid members right now, meaning that are organizations that fall into one or more of our categories as businesses or electric utilities. We have electric utilities both from the Rail Belt and from rural Alaska. Three of the Rail Belt utilities serve on REAP's board of directors right now: Homer Electric, Chugach Electric, and Matanuska Electric. We have NGOs that work on these kinds of issues, educational institutions like the University of Alaska, Alaska Center for Energy and Power. We have Native corporations and developers. That's who really represents our membership. And then we have what we call donors, people who support REAP through donations. We have hundreds of people who give over $100 a year. Yeah. We have hundreds more who give less than that. We have, I think, 50 people who are giving $1,000 a year or 40-some that are giving $1,000 a year to our organization. And our mailing list, I think, is around 3,500 people right now. As I mentioned before, we work statewide. And so our staff is always moving around the state. We have one staff here in Juneau and six based up in Anchorage. And as I mentioned before, just in our STEM education work, I think we went to 700 classrooms and well over thousands of students, I think over 5,000 students that we reached this last year. So we work with teachers that are not affiliated with us. We work with more than 30 other organizations like state and federal agencies who come to our board meetings and who can't vote but are interested in the work we do. So it's a pretty broad group that's been around for now we're on our 16th year.
Yeah, and I just want people to hear that because you have to deal with people who produce power and then people who are interested in renewables only and primarily, right? And there's a tension in there of the economics of it and the timing and history, basically. Can you change your infrastructure immediately? And you live under the tension of how to bring renewable demands into the kind of the economic world. And I think it's just interesting that you have been able to keep a group together under REAP that has been focused on this. And I just wanted people to understand both ACPERG and REAP have they're not speaking just from one small institutional perspective, but pretty broad. And so for people thinking that I didn't have a lineup of 100 people testifying, I wanted people to know that this is pretty significant voices that that we heard through today. So just for what it's worth.
Thank you, Chairman.
Other questions at this point? So the Senate is going to continue the meeting on Friday, and there are a couple things that I'll probably do, and this is for those testifying today and those in the room today. It was brought to my attention that, for example, on the Bradley Lake issue, there might be some further comment. I'm not going to allow it today, but I am going to suggest that on Friday on the Senate side we can go ahead and hear it because there's some clarifying remarks that maybe can be made, and I think Mr. Izzo wanted to bring those up. Then I'm going to have RCA come in and help us with a context issue, couple of context issues that I think are going to be important as we look at the structure of the bill, as well as some of the changes that have been suggested by both utilities and by ACPERG and others, that we can begin to show that these are the things that have risen to the most often commented. So on Friday, we'll be meeting in the Senate, and maybe I'll speak to the co-chairman here how the House is going to proceed.
Thank you, Senator. As we look forward to upcoming House meetings, the House Special Committee on Energy has to dovetail its schedule with the budget subcommittees as they move through the House right now. So we will not be meeting tomorrow as a special committee, but we will be meeting at 11:15, I believe, for the budget subcommittee and following the Senate's work Friday and next week as well. We'll be following that closely, and we'll have upcoming meetings scheduled. So please track what the Senate is doing in their hearings as we have our subcommittees, but I'll be updating you as well as we go along. And I want to thank my committee members for sitting through these hearings and participating closely. I'd like to thank their staff as well for keeping them up to date, and my staff, Joe Hardenbrook, for his work for setting this up as well, and the Senate members for joining us as well, and for Senator Coghill for chairing these committees. Thank you very much.
Just to let people know, we will be open to public testimony on Friday, and I will not close down the public testimony probably at that point, because we will have to contemplate a CS committee substitute coming in after that. So we'll keep public testimony live so that we can have people comment on what may come forward. My intention, though, is to move along, not let a lot of dust grow on this or grass grow under it, and move it on to the next committee referral once we've contemplated whatever changes we may contemplate. So on Friday, public testimony and any clarifying remarks are going to be welcomed in front of the committee. With that, thanks for the House members. Thanks to the Senate for allowing us to use their chambers. Thanks for the recording people and our LIO people and all interested. This meeting is adjourned.